When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we're focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is David Richards. David spent his early childhood as a military brat in various parts of the United States and a few years in Japan. Later, he followed in his dad's footsteps and joined the Marine Corps. And in this episode, we're going to talk about how David handled his transition out of the Marine Corps and realized that even seemingly impossible dreams can come true as he was transitioning out. So without further ado, welcome to the show, David. I'm glad to have you on.
Scott, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure. I was thinking back because I've been promoting my last book for a couple of years now, and this may be the first veteran-focused podcast I've done. So I'm really honored and excited to speak with you.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. And we love having veterans on to share their stories. Really, the heart of it is, you know, sharing your story, tell the things that you've gone through and what you've experienced and how you made things right. You know, like after getting out of the military, a lot of times, a lot of guys and women are coming out and they're just trying to make sense of the world because it's totally different coming out of the military into the civilian world.
Just a little.
And yeah, it is. And when you come out, it's like a whole new world. And so hearing stories from people like yourself and other veterans who've been there, done that, and gone through stuff, it just makes it so much more relatable and lets people know that, hey, so this guy did it, that gal did it, you know, whoever it was, they did it, and I could do it too. That gives some hope to people. So I'm hoping that we can kind of dig into your story a little bit and talk about where you were, where you are now, and how you got there. So I guess let's start off, just tell us a little bit more about yourself, your background, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So as you mentioned at the onset, I grew up in the military. So I was born into a military family. I was born at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, if anybody is familiar with that post there. It was strange because you don't know what life is supposed to be like. I mean, you know your life. And so growing up as a military dependent, I knew we moved a lot. As I was saying before we got on air, we lived for 4 years off base. And that was a dramatically different experience than living on base. But living on base and moving, it was part of my challenge growing up was I hated losing my friendships. And this was obviously well before the internet, well before you could FaceTime one another and say, hey, I miss you and all this other stuff. And it was like, so I grew up with this weird, in one sense, I was really creative. We spent 3 years in Japan when I was in fifth, sixth, and seventh grade. That was hugely impressionable for me. So that was the late 70s, early 80s, which I know could be ancient history for some people. But it was fascinating being exposed to Eastern culture and Eastern philosophy, and also being a foreigner on foreign soil. Like you knew you were in the minority and you were the one who kind of didn't belong in this land, so to speak, which was impactful. It gave me a huge appreciation for why the Marines had a base on Okinawa in the first place, but also the fact that Japan's culture was so fantastically different and unique from American culture. Came back to the States, I went to Camp Lejeune here on the coast of North Carolina, and very different. Now, suddenly, the mindset shifted, the culture shifted. It was high school popularity in the 80s, and it was kind of like, okay, what does that mean? But I realized that such a small fraction of my classmates had the experience of living overseas at that point. I mean, they just didn't. So that was a big change. So I was really creative in English writing, had some poetry that won contests, short story that won national recognition. That's kind of what I wanted to do. But growing up in a military base, you just don't appreciate how big the world is, even when you travel overseas. And you just don't appreciate what life is like on the other side of the fence. And that, for me, was just this big unknown. And so when it came time to college, I only applied to two places. I applied to Penn State and UNC. Penn State, because that was where my dad declared residency for our statehood. So we paid taxes in Pennsylvania. And UNC, just because Michael Jordan went there. And I thought it was cool. It was like 3 hours up the road from Cape Lejeune. But went to Penn State, majored in English, ROTC. Not knowing what to do and how to make it as a writer. I just said, I'll follow in my dad's footsteps, follow in my brother's footsteps. Joined the Marines, did that for 15 years. And then I was kind of like, I was literally following in my dad's footsteps. I was like, I will go in until they tell me to get out and do all this and I'll retire. And I had surgery in my neck. I had a tumor in my neck. And around 2005, that just kind of made me think like, what am I doing? Like, what am I really? I'm so, as much as I'm terrified and what's it on the other side of the fence, because I've never been a civilian, never in my entire life. And I never will, you know, I never really will be, but what is on the other side of that fence? So I made the decision to get out, immediately fell in love with yoga, was not part of my game plan, not part of my roadmap. And I didn't realize how much I needed that, but it was just such a big shift for me. And then was working corporate America and then kind of got to the point where I got back into writing and started working on my books.
I find it very interesting how you just said that you had never been a civilian throughout that whole experience, right? And yeah. Obviously, you weren't enlisted, you weren't an officer or anything
right.
while you were in elementary school or anything like that, but you were living the military lifestyle. You're living on a military base. You kind of just grew up around the military, and I get that. Like, it makes sense the way you said that. Like, you've never been a civilian. You never really the suburbs or whatever, and just hung out with the friends that you've had growing up all your life. It was that military life where you're moving every few years and you're making new friends and everything. And that's very similar to the experience of a lot of active duty service members where they're moving from one place to another. And I never really thought about it like that. And in the area that I live in now, we live right near an Air Force base. And so there's a lot of military families in our neighborhood that we've gotten to know over the years. They've come and gone because they've moved from one place to another. Funny enough, some of them have actually moved to Japan with young kids. And so I started thinking about them and their kids and what that experience must have been like for them. Obviously, nowadays they have the internet and they can keep in touch with you know, friends and things like that. But still going over to completely different culture where you probably don't speak the language, probably can't read the street signs and the things like that, right? The food, the culture, the everything is just totally different over there. And, you know, what's that like for a kid to be just plucked out of America and dropped into Japan? Like in that mindset of I've never been a civilian, it kind of clicked with me. And I was like, wow, that I never thought about it that way.
Yeah, well, so it's funny you said it because I was looking at reviewing my manuscript for my next book last night, and there's a part where I talk about when we were kids, and I mean like when I was 5 or 6, we used to play war, like it was just war, and like you had guns. Well, so like everyone on our street had plastic machine guns that made this like squirking, you know, that noise or whatever. My brother and I had the rifle wooden frames of M1 Garands that the Marine Corps had gotten rid of. So like who has that? Like we were literally going around with M1s that the Marines had used World War II and gotten rid of finally after Vietnam. And my brother and I were like going around, those were our guns. Like it was just surreal. So when we moved to Okinawa, even just the experience as a kid, I remember we flew from, I want to say we drove across country. We sold our car in Los Angeles and then took a plane from LAX to Alaska. And certainly that was the longest flight I'd ever been on at 9 years old. And you cross the international date line at some point and you're like, okay, now suddenly yesterday, it was like Sunday and now it's Monday. So we're like fast forward into the future somehow. And then landing in Okinawa, we landed in July 10:30 at night at Nahat International Airport. And literally the 50 yards it took to walk from the plane to the terminal, you are drenched in sweat. And so you're like, okay, interesting. And then we're driving to our hotel, and the Habu is one of the most poisonous snakes in the world. And it's on Okinawa. It's called the Habu. And so we're driving to our hotel, and we see some kids playing in the street with this giant snake. And you're like, okay, but Okinawa is fascinating. I mean, it's the island is not tremendously big, and there are certainly points on the island where you can be at a peak and look both on both sides of the island and see the water. And so being in kind of this tropical paradise was fascinating. Like, it was on base was so cool because I had two really good friends who were, they were a year younger than me, but we had so many things in common and we lived right next to each other. So it was fantastic. And then strange enough, we were the only three that I ever remember with any regularity that would go off base. And there was, it wasn't a fence that separated the on base from the base from off base. It was more like a cement, but an ornamented cement barrier kind of. And it had holes in it. And so like it had these little squares, grid squares almost. And one of the grid squares right by our house had been popped out. So we would sneak through that or cough or climb over the barbed wire to go off base. Like, so really here you see 10, 11 year old kids like navigating with ease the guard between off and off base. But, and so we would just like the candy, like you're right. I mean, it smelled different. It looked different. I mean, certainly Okinawa then, you know, was not well affluent. It wasn't like, you know, I mean, some of the places we'd walk by were these shanties and it was like corrugated aluminum houses. I mean, it's really thin stuff, but you could, you know, smell the food there. You could also smell, they had the latrine, like they had what used to call Benjo ditches, which is where like the basically the sewer is, but it's aerated. So you can smell it. So it's not necessarily super pleasant. But it was, I mean, it was just, everything was so different. Everybody, obviously, Okinawans look completely different than Americans, and they're everywhere. Very few blondes. You know, you saw people who had bleached their hair, you could tell kind of, but all the school kids wore uniforms. Most of the Mamasans you saw still wore like the traditional kind of older kimono, but it was so different. And that was the cool thing was, I remember, you know, as a kid, you're focused on like toys. And so we'd go see like Japanese toys, and they were so much more intricate and detailed. It made me like American back in the time, it was like, I remember we had action figures like G.I. Joe, which was probably like a foot tall, or you'd have a little Superman, your Batman things, but they're all really rigid. And in Okinawa, they're like very detailed and intricate, and they're small. And so it was like fascinating. And, you know, we used it as a stepping stone. My dad was very, having been in Vietnam, I think my dad wanted at least to expose us to the Orient to a certain extent. So between the 3 years in Japan, we went to South Korea twice. We went to the Philippines twice or three times. And it was fascinating because, you know, their rituals, their festivals, their temples, completely different. You'd walk through the woods and see, or the jungle rather, and see like tombs built into the mountainside and stuff. And so it was, I mean, it was a really fascinating experience.
Yeah, that's great. And I think that's a unique part of the military life is you get to go and experience all these different cultures when you travel overseas like that, whether it's to Japan or Korea or Germany or, you know, other places around the world that we station troops. You know, it's just really interesting that you get that experience. A lot of the civilian counterparts, you know, the 9-year-old kids in America, they don't just get that kind of experience unless they were fortunate enough to travel someplace on a vacation, but they usually don't go and live someplace else and experience a culture for an extended period of time like that.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward a bit. So after you get out of the military and you talked about how, you know, you got into yoga, you got into the corporate America, and then you got back into writing. What was that transition all like for you? Did you have a game plan coming out of the military, or you sort of wing it as you're coming out? What was that all like for you?
Yeah. So not having a frame of reference of what something outside the military looked like. And even just reflecting on what you just asked, the question, I didn't have a game plan. I knew salary wise what I hoped to make. And it was kind of like, I had started out in artillery, and then I lat moved to communications around the time the Marine Corps is merging single channel with digital. And so I felt like IT was a place that I could play in. But I only applied to like three places to work. I applied to a defense contractor outside Quantico. I applied to Cisco Systems, the IT giant. And then one, I had gone to a special school and I got a bachelor's degree, but it was also like a very specific school on kind of the art of warfighting that the Marine Corps did, the School of Advanced Warfighting. And one of the alums had gotten out and had started a security firm in the Middle East out of UAE, I want to say, or Bahrain. And so I applied there because I was like, I could be like a mercenary. And it sounded like this romantic swashbuckling kind of thing, which, okay. And then as I kind of looked at my options, I knew the swashbuckling thing was, it certainly could be cool. I mean, that would be like cutting edge stuff potentially, but also I would never have a normal life. Like I would just, that's committing yourself to a lifestyle that you don't necessarily come back from. The defense contractor, it was someone that I had worked with previously. And so I thought that could be a good option, but I also kind of wanted to, I wanted to do something different. Like I wanted to like challenge myself. And so Cisco, we worked with Cisco to an extent in IT and comms in the Marines, but not obviously like not the company itself. And to step into that world, I thought would be really compelling. So my resume got passed on from someone I went to school with at Penn State. The hiring manager that I spoke with was a former Marine too, or Marine. So we clicked on that space and he was like, I want you to come in and manage our Navy accounts, you know, from a post-sales perspective. And I was like, okay, whatever that means, post-sale, I'll figure that out. But so I did. And it was honestly, Scott, for me, again, even though I wasn't on active duty the first 18 years of my life or 20 years of my life or whatever, but I had that military mindset. I lived in the military for that time. And so getting out, I was like, for the first 5 or 6 years, every week, I compared what happened that week in corporate America to what my experience was in the military. Cause it was just, I was the only frame of reference I had. And so it was, in some ways it was very cool. In some ways I wanted to really focus on what it meant to be in a place where you didn't, it was just such a fascinating transition. You asked specifically, I'll give you some examples. Like in the Marines, you don't really have boundaries. Like anything is, you can discuss anything virtually with anybody. Like, and it's just, especially if you're deployed, like there's no hold barred. So I'd been at Cisco 3 months and had gone to lunch with some, I was a manager. I'd gone to lunch with some of the engineers who were employees who reported to me, and then some who were just on our team. And we're walking back into the building and the guy I was talking to, I'm like, man, I got to take a, and I said a colorful way for having to go to the bathroom. And he looks at me in disgust. He's like, keep it to yourself. And I was like, oh, you don't talk about that. Oh my gosh. Like you guys have boundaries. Like, whoa. And it was this big revelation. And so in some ways I was like, I have to be really careful what I say. Like you can't just be like, oh, this is whatever. And so that was kind of that pumped my brakes a little bit, but it also made me appreciate that people, the biggest piece that I came to realize about the transition was in a lot of ways in the military, people are the last thing you're focused on is yourself in many ways, like the absolute last, you're not talking about designing or shaping your life. You're doing your career and going where the needs of Marine Corps or military send you. And in the civilian world, it is completely different. People have like, this is my thing, this is what I'm doing. I don't care about you, I don't care what you're doing. And it was just this fascinating shift. And in some ways that was as radical a shift as yoga was, that was also the pathway for helping me kind of connect myself to something outside the military. Because obviously being exposed to philosophy, you know, Eastern culture in Japan, I took away some semblance of like a meditation practice, started meditating when I was really young. Wasn't great at it, but that was part of what led me into yoga. But then really it was understanding what it means to be successful in the job that I was in and how to interact with people in a way to respect and appreciate that they had boundaries in terms of how they wanted to be interacted with.
Right.
Which again, in the military, you don't really have to worry about. And that took time. I mean, that took a lot of time for me.
Yeah. That is something that it's actually interesting when you said those boundaries. I thought to myself, okay, I think I know where he's going with this, because just the way you talk to people in the military is totally different. And those boundaries don't exist the way they do in the civilian world. You can literally talk about just about anything, and people will laugh it off. People, you know, it resonates differently with people in the military than it does outside in the civilian world. And, yeah. You know, I found myself too, just biting my tongue sometimes. Like, I know I want to say this, but if I do, everyone in the room is going to be looking at me like I got three heads, because this is not going to fly right. So, so that was a big thing, I think, for a lot of people coming out of the military. It's like, how do I even talk to these people? It's like I'm on a foreign land trying to learn new culture, customs, and things like that, you know?
And especially in, you know, what's made having been Cisco so fascinating. Cisco is a global company. And part of the realization of the company is the internet, in particular, since that's really what they do, is about and for everyone. It's not about certain people with certain beliefs. And it opens up the company in a lot of ways. And that makes you appreciate that everyone wants to be treated as an individual. And certainly in the military, where individual identity succumbs to the organizational identity to a great extent, that is a huge transition to make. Because again, like you said, in the military, I mean, I remember we used to joke unabashedly, and nothing was really off limits, and it wasn't insensitive because anything was game, and like, it didn't matter if you were an officer or enlisted, if you were going to participate, it was a brotherhood or a sisterhood. And to get out and you say it's not that way, but that's the great thing about being a civilian or being in the civilian world, is it's not supposed to be that way. Like, the whole purpose of the military is to afford people the luxury of being able to create their own life on their terms. And even that was, for me, the biggest adjustment to make, was certainly growing up in the military and feeling like I didn't have a choice in where we lived, and obviously no kid really does. And then deciding that's what I'm going to do for an occupation for a while was a great way to realize that, oh, well, like, this is what I thought I'm supposed to do. And then finally I got this point, like, wait, I can do something else. And when you get out, you realize, oh, I can do anything I set my mind to, as long as they have a plan and the tenacity to see it through. That is a completely, like, in some ways, the resiliency that you find in the Marine Corps is a tool, or the military is a tool that you can use to say, okay, let me start to get really clear on the future that I want to create for myself and my family. And that, at least for me, that took some practice and time to figure out how to do that really well.
Yeah. And when you talk about, like, getting out of the military and saying you could do anything that you put your mind to and put the effort in for, that's a big thing. You could do anything.
Yeah.
Like, that, you could be a politician, you could be a doctor, you could be a janitor, you could be, like, there's some choices you got to make with your life as you're coming out, right?
You could be a filmmaker. And that's, it's a little overwhelming, but at first it's
right.
Like, for me, it's just first, okay, what are the rules of the game here? Because it's obviously different than what I was doing for the, you know, last part of my life. And that takes time to figure out. It does. And thankfully, at least now, I feel like there's a greater abundance of veteran friendly communities in a lot of companies and stuff, because it's essential to help. And that has certainly helped me. Like, how do you, like, I remember talking to vets about how you talk to other people, how do you talk to women? Because I didn't spend a great deal of time in the Marine Corps around women, like, certainly not the first, you know, 5 or 7 years when I was in combat arms. And all those things require practice and familiarity. And then when you kind of say, okay, I get it, then it's like, oh, wait a minute, I can, like, I have a lot of control. Like, I have an incredible amount of control. And that's what, you know, especially in this day and age where technology has transformed and evolved the way it has, there's this rise of the entrepreneurial spirit within the United States now. Certainly we've seen that recent years, like, Amazon has basically shuttered the mall industry. Etsy is this unique home for unique things that people come up with their own. And it's fascinating. It's like, okay, what do I want to do in the next phase? How do I make a big impact to society and contribute? So, yeah.
Yeah. Did you have any doubts about yourself and, like, where you're going as you were making this transition? And if you did, like, what were you doing to overcome those doubts and that stuff that you had talking to yourself in the back of your head, like, can I actually do this? You know?
Yeah. Well, the best example is probably my writing, because the reason I gave up on writing when I joined the Marines was because I needed to figure out what does it mean to be a Marine? Like, how do I lead Marines? And then going into Somalian Operation Restore Hope, like, writing isn't something that's top of mind for you. Like, you're just, it's not in the brain. But then in around 2000, I got inspired. I had a boss who was a full bird colonel, but had been a Boston police officer. Well, it's now military police, my battalion commander. And he painted, like, he had paintings that he had done in his office. And I was blown away. I was like, whoa, because you do not, I love my fellow Marines, all of them. I had never seen that kind of artistry in the Marine Corps. Like, I did not see it. And so we connected, like, best boss I ever worked for in the military, certainly brought the best out of me. And I started writing poetry again. Also, I was pursuing a master's in psychology, and there was a woman in one of my classes shared a really poignant story, and she kind of became my muse, and I got inspired to write poetry again. And even that, I'll just share candidly that when fellow officers found out I read poetry, their first question was, are you gay? And I was like, what? You haven't even read my poetry. Like, you don't even know, like, I wrote about Achilles, and it is not a good poem. Like, it's not a happy poem. But that was kind of the mindset that people had. And so, like, it's not something that I promoted actively, like, hey, come read my poetry. It's just, like, it was this weird thing. So when I got out, and finally, even though I was traveling a lot for work, I was stationed, like, I came home to the same place. And so much of my life, literally for the first 36 years or so, had been measured by how much time I had left at the place I was. And I made decisions on relationships. I made decisions on, like, what I was going to do, like, in the time of that. I just made those decisions. And now that stopgap wasn't 2 years out or 3 years out. I could potentially stay in one place for as long as I wanted. That was fascinating to me. And that opened up the door for me that I could start writing again. And so probably about 2 years after I got out, I was settled enough in the corporate world. I was teaching yoga. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready to start writing my first book. And I wanted to write horror stories. I loved Stephen King growing up. I love Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And so I kind of wanted to be the next Stephen King. So I had an idea because I'd lived in this place at the same time, and it wasn't going anywhere. I just had a feel for the town I was in. And I wrote about 110 pages over, I don't know, a couple months. And it wasn't great, but I just couldn't make it go any further. And so I got really dejected, and finally I found an excuse to stop writing and then let it go. Probably about a year later, year and a half later, same thing happened. New inspiration, new story. And same thing happened. 110, 120 pages. I couldn't develop the characters further. And I was just so frustrated. I couldn't understand it. And at some point, like, I was having success in work, and I felt that was good. I was still learning what it meant to, really what yoga was about and what it meant to be an instructor. But the writing thing was calling to me. So it went on for 11 years. 11 years, I tried to write my first book from 2006 to 2017. And I'd gone through a marriage during that time. I got into a relationship, and it just so happened, like, my last attempt to write a book, in Hell Horror Story, had been in 2016. And it was the best idea I had. It was a really cool, like, end of days, apocalyptic sort of thing. I mean, just really powerful. But same thing happened, 120 pages or so. And then for Christmas, someone gave me a whiskey and yoga t-shirt, because I was a big scotch drinker at the time. And obviously with yoga and the irony of it all. And then I started reading Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. And that book transformed my life. I read the first or second chapter. And in the chapter, one of the chapters, he talks about, what is your purpose in life? And Scott, I was blown away, because the idea that my life had purpose was fascinating. Like, it was this huge wake-up call. And so I had tremendous doubts up until that point. And I was so exasperated, because I knew that writing was a passion that was calling to me, that it called to me my entire life. I postponed it when I was in the Marines, and now I wanted to reinvigorate it. And initially the angle was, I would write stories that would scare people. When I read Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, and it became about, how do I contribute to other people? And how can I help them find their purpose in life? I got so excited. I wrote a life purpose statement. And then I stood on writing my first book. And 6 months later, I wrote it. So tremendous doubt, and certainly tremendous doubt in the corporate world too. For a while, I thought about, should I join the reserves? Still want to do that. And I had a boss who was like, you make just as much money if you don't do that. And in some ways he was right. But in some ways I was like, you know what? I was just tired of the military. Like, I love the service. I love what it did for me, everything, the opportunities I had to do. But after 30 something years, I was like, okay, it's enough. So absolutely full of doubt, because doubt is, you kind of have to turn into your doubt and face it, because it's just whittling away at helping you. It's helping you understand who you are supposed to be and who you're not supposed to be, kind of. So,
yeah, it's great how you kept coming back to the writing and didn't give up after that first, few times that you're writing, and then it seemed like you hit that roadblock and you couldn't keep going. You kept trying, try something else. Okay, fine. This story, maybe this story wasn't the one. It's not, that one's not working, but try something else and you start new. And okay, fine. That one's not it either, but you kept going and you kept going. And eventually you got to the point where you're doing the thing that you wanted to do in the first place, writing. And I want to be sure that we leave some time to talk about these books too, because that to me is an important part of this whole thing, is the end result. You know, you just talked about how much of a struggle it was for you to keep going and push through and overcome that doubt and figure out what your purpose was, what that was. And you ended up with a couple books and you're still writing at this point. And that's amazing that you've gotten through all of the obstacles that you had in your way and you kept pushing through, and here you are now with something to show for it, for all of that hard work. And during that time, I'm sure it must have been a struggle to be going through all of that and thinking to yourself, maybe I just don't have what it takes to be a writer or whatever. And
absolutely no, I honestly, it was first, I didn't have a good writing practice. What I mean by that is, we live in this day and age where the internet provides us such instant gratification all the time. And I felt like if I was taking the time to write, that what I was writing must be perfect. That was kind of my mindset going in. And I labored, I would write, but I wanted everything to be perfect. So like I would spend what felt like probably minutes trying to get the right sentence and then the next sentence. And it was just like, it wasn't flowing. And I didn't appreciate it. I didn't write just for the sake of writing. I didn't write to like make it organic. And so it was incredibly frustrating. And then when I made this shift to be like, okay, I'm not going to be a horror writer, I'm now going to write self-help, it was different, because now it's about, all right, I'm going to share my personal experiences and how I grew from those things. And that was a little bit exasperating, but at the same time, it was scratch that itch. Like, you have wanted to be a writer your whole life. Is it important for you to be a horror writer, or is it important for you to write and get a message out there and contribute? And that was a big shift. And even writing Whiskey and Yoga, my first book, that was like every day I sat down to write, it was a struggle, because it was like, can I do this? I've been trying for 11 years to write a book. I haven't. Can I finish? Like, I remember even like how I set the book up. I was just like, let me get to 150 pages. Just let me get to 150 pages of the thing, which is like a silly way to write. But I did. Like, I don't remember what it ended up being, but I did. And that was this great relief. And the book went to number one on Amazon. It was huge, but it also opened up. I remember I did the big book launch to help support it. And a week after the launch, someone who helped me with the launch, who'd had some success already, said, well, okay, what's next? What's your platform? What are you going to talk about? And I'm like, oh, I have to have a platform. I thought my book was just going to change the world. I didn't know I had to do something else. And so it kind of started pulling on this thread. But again, that's the magic of really getting clear on what you want. And for me, it was writing became not an obsession, but I kind of started to understand the process of writing. And that's why, a lot of people think that, or a lot of people say that public speaking is the scariest thing in the world. I would contend for most people, it's private speaking. It's how you talk to yourself, because invariably, if you journal or if you start writing a story, you are having a conversation with yourself in some way. And for a lot of people, that is too terrifying a concept to grasp, but we can all do it. Like, we can all have that conversation. And so certainly my writing process has shifted since then. I write just almost every day, and it's very organic, and it's one of my favorite things to do.
Yeah. And we all do that, whether we're writing a book or not. We all do have those conversations with ourselves. We talk to ourselves, and just that little voice that's in the back of your head that's telling you, that's a good idea to go do this, or don't do that, or oh man, that was stupid that you did this, or man, you should really feel good about that other thing that you did, right? And so we all have that voice. And you're right, especially when you're writing about your own personal experiences and story, and I did that with my book as well, it's kind of like you're having that conversation with yourself. Or in a weird way, it was like I was having conversations with people who I was writing about in the book, but I was having that conversation in my head.
Yeah.
What would so-and-so say if I said this? And, you know, what was that conversation like? And it's just a strange process. But, you know, I'm glad that you found the thing that you wanted to get out there to benefit the world. Not to say being a fiction writer, a horror writer or something like that wouldn't be impactful. Obviously, people like Stephen King and other writers in that genre, they have had their impact on society. And people need those kind of books too. And those are great, but it just didn't seem like it was flowing for you. So, you know, pivot and just change directions. And you're still writing. You said, you write every day and you're still doing this. It's a thing that you're passionate about and that you love doing. And here you are and doing it. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the books that you have? So Whiskey and Yoga, you mentioned, is one of them. And then The Lighthouse Keeper is the other one, if I'm not mistaken. And tell us about those books and what they're all about.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Scott. So Whiskey and Yoga, again, was really kind of a lifetime journey to publishing my first book. But it's a very simple book. It's a weekend read, really. It's a quick read. But the book is about finding your purpose in life and how all of us have a magnetic north that we are guided to. And it's not a job. It's not a specific function. It's something deeper that guides us to have a fulfilling life while doing tremendous achievements and accomplishments to help other people, to serve other people. And it's really just a series almost of vignettes on kind of experiences I had and what led me to find my purpose and how people can find their purpose too. And a lot of it is simple as just writing the question down. What is my purpose in life? Because if you write that question down, physically do it in the act of writing, not necessarily on a computer, but in the act of pen and paper, your mind will come up with an answer. And, you know, I wrote my first one in 2017. I rewrote it later that year when I went to a Tony Robbins event. And then I rewrote it again this past December at a previous Tony Robbins event. And so Whiskey and Yogi gave birth to The Lighthouse Keeper. And The Lighthouse Keeper was two little sections in Whiskey and Yoga. And it was really born out of my experience of being a yoga instructor. And part of what drew me to yoga, and it's probably a good place to talk about this, is when I got my last assignment in the Marines, working in Southern Command out of Miami. And so I spent a lot of time in Central America. And this was, like I said, mid-2000s. But I would, like, on average, I would get like 50 email a week. I mean, just, I wasn't spending a lot of time on the computer, especially if I was in Honduras or Panama or someplace. And then when I got to Cisco, I would get 50 email like in 2 hours. And it was nuts. Like the volume of email and just like, how do I manage this thing called an inbox? Like, what is this? And I would leave work and my mind, between the radio being on, my mind would just be this congested freeway of traffic. It would be to-do lists. It would be reminders. It would be meetings that I had to have. It would be people I was meeting with and how I was going to like deal with that meeting. And it was just all this stuff. And what I found really quickly, probably after my second or third class doing yoga, was when I got onto a yoga mat, all that noise went away. And it was like, whoa, what is this? Like, it's quiet in my head. I could focus like my attention on stuff. And that was a really cool experience. And so that was certainly for the first few years as an instructor, that was really what I focused on, was what's the relationship between you and what you observe? Because how you observe something is almost important as what you're observing, where you're putting your attention. And two people can look at something and have completely different experiences. I can look at a vase of roses and say, oh my God, that's so beautiful. And someone else can look at it and say, it makes them think of a funeral they just attended. So it's two completely experiences. So The Lighthouse Keeper was really this idea that our mind is an ocean, and that's where all your memories are. Everybody you've ever met is in this ocean. And then your lighthouse, the lighthouse, is where you put your awareness. So this idea that most of us develop patterns and routines in our life. So day after day, especially if you work the same job for an extended period of time, your lighthouse just goes in the same pattern. Well, the premise behind Lighthouse Keeper is with focus, with meditation, with willpower, and a kind of a direction on where you want to take your life, who you want to become in the future version of yourself, you can start to direct your awareness to go where you want it to go in the lighthouse instead of reacting to this pattern that you've created. And it's a larger metaphor for life, obviously, that what we focus on would bring more into our life. And so the key is then to focus on things that we want as opposed to things that we don't want, so that we can bring the things we want more into our life.
I think both of those sound like they have some pretty incredible messages there. That analogy, or that the visual of having the your life being that ocean, and every experience, every person, everything that you've experienced in that life is in that ocean, and then, you know, was drawing you, you know, towards the lighthouse and everything. I think all of that just seems like it has a lot of good stuff in there. So definitely want people to go check out those books. Where can people go to find your books?
Yeah, thank you. So they're both available on Amazon. So you can find them on Amazon, Whiskey and Yoga and The Lighthouse Keeper. Or you can go to davidrichardsauthor.com, my website, and they're both available there as well. So I'd encourage you to check them out. I'm really looking forward to releasing my next book in December. But The Lighthouse Keeper is a great read. It's fun. I just had someone who gave me some nice comments about it the other day. But that was fun for me because it was a fiction book. And that was finally, like, I got to write a fiction book. It was still self-help, obviously, with what I just shared.
Sure.
But the fact that I could make a story out of it was pretty exciting to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And it got you into that fiction world as well.
It did.
You were trying to get into. And so that's good. It's maybe wasn't the horror that you're looking for necessarily, but it's still a step in the right direction to get there. And who knows, maybe one of these days you'll have a horror book in you and that will come out as well.
I did, but there are some spooky spots in The Lighthouse Keeper. I will say there's some, the first night in the lighthouse is a little claustrophobic and the storm comes in. So it's pretty cool, but
yeah,
it's not Stephen King quality yet. So.
Well, you know, honestly, when you mentioned the lighthouse, and I started thinking of the old Scooby-Doo episodes and thinking of them like walking through and you know, finding the ghost or something like that in there. It kind of had that spookiness to it as well. Probably not exactly what you were going for, but that was the first thought that popped.
I'll take it, Scott. If it's a Scooby-Doo, much props to Scoob. So I'll take it.
Awesome. So I will have links to your website and to your books in the show notes. So anyone who wants to take a look at the books and pick up a copy, definitely check out the show notes and you'll find all the links to them there. David, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. I really do appreciate you taking the time to come on the show, sharing your experience, your transition out of the military, and how you got to where you are now as a writer, and following that passion and overcoming all those doubts that you had about yourself along the way. I think it's inspiring, and I hope other people will take a page out of your playbook and apply that to their lives as well.
Scott, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm looking forward to promoting this with my audience, and so grateful for what you're doing.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Drive On Podcast.